You know, any kind of memos that you write up, think pieces, whatever, connected to forming these research groups, and as kind of clusters emerge. So there are, I think, four thematic, topical, emergent groups already posted. I know that when we went around last week, some people had strong topical preferences, other people had more thematic preferences. You know, so Lindsay's interest in the labor process and relations of production could get connected with several possible topical, sectoral kinds of interests, and some of the interests on funding. So I think we'll kind of feel our way towards how we'll do this. Aicha raised the question of the size of these groups, given that the seminar has gotten a little smaller. I think we should just treat this entirely in a kind of productivity maximizing way. You know, if a two-person group seems really good, two people have very meshing interests and they really want to do it, that's fine too. There may also be possibilities for a larger group with kind of sub-clusters. I think we can really think of this in whatever way emerges. Emmanuel had some... Did anyone else besides you go to that Resilience Center?
No one from his class.
Yeah. So he went to the Resilient Center. Resilient or Resilience?
Resilience.
It may also be a Resilient Center.
Resilience.
Yeah, so maybe just say a few words about it. We were talking just a little bit, just so people hear what's...
So the resilience research and goes back to also the email that Nate sent around, summarizing the project, and it's basically kind of a brainchild of an NGO that's called the Center for Resilient Cities, which is based in Madison, but it also partners with Growing Power, with... a couple of other partners, some gardens.
Troy Gardens. And the Badger School, Badger Rock.
Badger Rock School, and...
we have big projects in Milwaukee also.
Yeah.
Badger Rock School hasn't actually started yet, right? That's in the planning stage.
No. Yeah. And the main idea, I guess, is that it's centered kind of around the school at this stage. So they're planning to open a charter school by next autumn. And surrounding the charter school, there'd be quite a bit of like urban farming going on. The school would be kind of integrated with farming, so the curriculum of the school would be very project-based and community-based. So the idea is that the kind of urban gardening going around the school, kind of drawing the community, several kind of projects, and that eventually there'll be some kind of local businesses kind of situated on the grounds of the local garden surrounding the school as well. And was there any other aspect to it, apart from the school?
There's an energy center.
An energy center.
So that MG&E, the local utility, is going to have some sort of alternative energy center. And on the website, they mention a business center.
Yeah.
But
like a business incubation center?
Yeah, but we were talking to an RA who's doing research on this, and he... it seems like not everything that's on the website is current.
No.
So they may have dropped that.
So at this stage, the project is very much kind of in the starting phase. They purchased the land in which the school would be situated, in which they've started farming. There's not that much going on at this stage. With the help of, I think, a former mayor of Madison.
Sagler?
Sensenberg.
Brought in the money with which the center bought the land. And so the first phase will be to get the school running next autumn, and then like bring in like small businesses and the other research kind of centers centered around the school will, I guess, come in as time goes by.
They also got a planning grant from the Department of Public Instruction, so state money to plan for their charter school.
Yeah. You know, this seems to me like a terrific opportunity, even if it's not up and running, so you can't sort of study the functioning of a well-established social economy experiment, to be able to, in real time, study something that's in formation where you could interview the different kinds of parties and then see what other exemplars that they're trying to copy and improve on, to really map out this initial point of departure. That's a manageable project for a semester and could provide really valuable ideas and information around the design that they have in mind. And then, you know, some, either if somebody in this group or other would want to follow up and track it over time, that would also be possible. So I do think it seems like a really good possibility. And a couple of people were interested in agriculture, so this could certainly be kind of the anchor for an agro-food cluster.
Another issue which already is crystallized, which is quite clear, is like a financing issue. So where will they get the money from? How will we support them?
Yeah, it seems like they're very self-consciously interested in replicability and designing for that, and also constantly doing research to see whether how it's affecting the community and whether it's replicable.
This also raises another just general issue just I want to briefly ask your views about, which is for our weekend mini-conference at the end of the semester, one person already for sure is coming, Craig Barowski. I sent around an email to direct you to his social economy, solidarity economy website, which was pretty thorough, and he teaches this material at Haverford. He said he has gotten funding from Haverford to come and we'll just join in, and then I said we'd be happy to carve out a slot. We have plenty of time on the weekend for him to talk about his own work on this. So one issue is, how much interest would there be in us further opening this event up? There's a number of possibilities. For example, Michael Bell is working on, has some research interests involved with the Brazilian Center. We could ask Michael and his part of that to come and present whatever they're doing. I could make it known on the U.S. Social Economy Network that we're holding this weekend workshop and just see if anybody can manage to get here. We won't have any funding for people, but if they can come, then they're welcome to participate, and we'll find time on the weekend for them to present anything they want to. Is that appealing to kind of make this a kind of an open workshop of that sort? Because I don't, you know, my prediction is if we made it, if we publicized it well and made it open this way, we'd probably get a half a dozen people. I can't imagine 50 people showing up. But. The one logistical issue that it would raise is for people who come from outside, I'd like to assure them that we can find a, you know, somebody's house for them to stay at the night before and the night after, so that they, since the conference is scheduled for Saturday morning through Sunday afternoon, it would mean a Friday night and Sunday night that we would need to, amongst ourselves, find a guest room. I can put up a couple of people, but just everybody feels comfortable with doing that? Okay. Good, okay, so I will let the Social Economy Network people know about it. I'll tell Craig also that he can let people in his own network know about it, and we'll just see if more people want to come. All right, next week, I would like to, if at all possible, nail down the research clusters so that we can really, you know, have that basic pattern set. I know it may take an extra week. It doesn't matter really if it's next week or the following week. But let's shoot for people talking about it amongst yourselves on the car rides back and forth to Milwaukee, in email and other things. See if we can have this begin to seriously gel by next week. I know that Matt and Tylan have kind of formed an alliance around the health stuff. Okay. So today, we have a special treat to have a focused discussion with one of the members of the seminar. I decided, and I emailed Kathleen about this, that it didn't make as much sense for me to distill an agenda out of this, given the purposes of this discussion, and rather Kathleen has had a chance to read it, and I asked if she would like to just begin by responding to some of the issues, and then let's just open it up as a more kind of freewheeling discussion. With the, as I said last time, the kind of double I, one is, and above all, to focus on Kathleen's master's and to think about the substantive issues and then possible ways in which it could be refined and extended for publication. But then also, at the maybe towards the end, to draw out from the discussion we have specific questions we'd like to keep in mind when we go to Growing Power on Saturday. So, Kathleen.
Well, I have to say that, just, I don't know, quintuples or whatever larger number is the number of people who have ever read my thesis. Beyond the people on my committee, I don't think anybody had ever read it. So the fact that I had, almost 20 people go to read this thesis and give me feedback on it was kind of daunting, but also, I was kind of like, it's pretty cool. And the feedback that I got from you really was just much more substantive than anything that I had gotten from my committee. So appreciate the opportunity that Eric gave me, really, to have a lot of people read it and give me feedback. So I had a day and a half kind of to look through it, and it was something I did a while ago, and I was telling some people I wrote the thesis. I gave birth to my older son in February, and I defended in May, so I was nursing and napping and not getting any sleep and writing this thesis. So as I was reading back through it, I was like, oh yeah, I kind of remember that.
But that's where I dozed off.
A little bit, it's a little foggy for you. But anyway, so so what I did was I kind of went through everybody's comments, and then I wrote comments back to you. And so I thought maybe I'd just go through and share those. Last time I wrote everybody's name down as we went around, and I don't have that sheet of paper, so I'm not sure of everybody's name. So I will, I'll try to, just went in the order that I have on here. So, so Lindsay, Lindsay's comments were first, right? Lindsay, okay. So your focus was kind of on how much input was gathered from neighbors in the development of Growing Power, and that's something that. I didn't get any history on, and the development of, from a neighborhood's perspective. The context of the neighborhood that they're in, what I did get, was more around the, Will often tells a story about the compost. I mean, these huge compost heaps, there, which ostensibly would be very smelly and very offensive to the neighbors, but weren't because the neighbors were involved in Growing Power. So I don't know anything about the development of it, though, and I don't think there necessarily was from the history that I know, because he bought the farm. I mean, he bought the property, so I'm not sure it was kind of getting a bunch of neighbors together and then forming that.
A lot of the comments I had weren't really so much about your thesis, and it was just kind of like almost like a knee-jerk reaction, kind of like that practical, just thinking about the practical side and some of the problems that you raised, just like.
So what else? And then employees versus volunteers. I really appreciated that because that came up a lot about the role of those two, and that wasn't an angle. So I did this in a geography program. That just wasn't an angle that I looked at. So when you talked about it, a number of people talked about that. There aren't a lot of employees. I mean, they do rely quite heavily on volunteers, both from the university, from UWM, from Marquette, also from the neighborhood. So the people that are employed, and I was thinking about the different people and what they did, and then I went back and looked on the website even just to remind me, and they've got a person that does financial work, they've got a person that runs the market basket program, a person that runs volunteers, so there's enough people to warrant a person's job description, as part of their job description, to be coordinating volunteers. Person that drives the produce truck down south and then back. So there's a number of different people that are employed, but there is quite a bit of work on volunteers. So some of the work that volunteers did, you know, included things like setting up the market basket bags, for example, you know, clearing plants and working in the greenhouse. So, you know, harvesting, packing the market basket. So I'm not sure there's, at least in the actual operations, a ton of distinction between what a volunteer would do and what an employee would do, with some exceptions that I mentioned. Other things that you mentioned.
I think just to stay on that.
Yeah.
is it okay if we jump around?
Yeah.
Okay. What about in terms of sort of the role of volunteers versus employees in decision making for the organization?
Yeah, and you know, that was another big, you know, component. I didn't really get into decision making about how decisions were made. I can give you what my thoughts are on how it was, but I didn't study that. So, you know, volunteers did what was necessary to be done at the time. So, you know, if there was, you know, this job to do, you know, people were donating more of their time, and, you know, whatever needed to be done during that time period, that's what was done. I'm not sure that they were involved in a broader sense. I know they had staff meetings. You know, that's about it. I mean, I don't know, I just don't know much about the rest of it.
But is it the employees who are identifying what needs to be done at specific times? Or are they realizing that in their own volunteer work and just organically figuring it out?
Again, just from my, you know, perspective, I mean, people would we would be given assignments. I mean, because I was volunteering, you know, I was just to get a feel for things. I mean, and people would tell me what to do. They'd say, okay, you want it? I'm coming in. You know, what needs to be done today? I could say what needs to be done. They'd say you can do this, you can do this. Yes, okay.
And those people, just to press a little bit, and those people are the employees of Growing Power.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's a core, you know, there's a core group of people that are employed. That are there, that are kind of the core that, you know, people would go to and say, what do I need to do next, or whatever. So yes, they were the ones that were giving the assignments.
Emmanuel, no, there was the same question. I was wondering who told you.
Yeah. you also asked about the employees, kind of their racial, social background of the employees themselves. So there's a couple different clusters. So the adult employees, I mean, the people that are, you know, I'm thinking of a couple, the market basket work, director, the co-director, I looked up her title, Karen, as somebody I would hope is there. She plays a really integral role and has known Will a long time. And whenever I see her, I tell her that, you know, somebody should write a book about her, because she knows a lot and has done a lot of the work to support the growth of the organization. Anyway, so a mix of racial backgrounds, certainly a fair number of African Americans, like more than half, you know, when I was there, of the people that were there on a regular basis. The other half, you know, were probably, you know, 20-ish something white women that were, and then, you know, a couple, you know, maybe older 40s, 50s white men. So. Kind of a mix, I mean, more so than you would get. And in terms of age range, like a decent age range. And then their teen program, you know, part of his thing was, and I'm not exactly sure, I don't recall if they're paid or not. I don't remember. But anyway, one of his things is to get teens involved, and he does academic work with teens and also gets them involved in production and in urban farming. So, you know, and those teens, there's a lot of African American teens that are part of that program. So that was kind of some of the things I think that you asked. Is this how you want me to do this?
Yeah, this is fine. This you know, and it'll trigger.
Yeah, I mean, Michael, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, you know, employees' relationship and decision-making seemed like was kind of a key theme for you. You know, I looked briefly at the board, you know, and who sat on the board. So they do have a board of directors, as an advisory board. You know, their relationship directly to employees, I don't know. And again, it wasn't something that I did much in. So I think it's a great area, because I don't know. But I know that there's a board. I know they have staff meetings.
Is the board of directors a community-based board, or is it notables?
You know, there's a couple notables. I mean, Jerry Kaufman from here, from UW, is on it.
We should have asked
him. He's been the chair.
Yeah,
for a long time.
Yeah, had him, he probably would know some
of it. He would know a ton of stuff. I mean, he'd be a good person to talk to.
He's a retired professor in ag econ?
Urban planning.
Urban planning.
Yeah. Other people, you know, there's people from Walnut Way, so community organizations. I printed out people. Retired teacher, Amaranth Bakery. Looks like a couple, FRECO Fund, a kitchen table project, Legal Action of Wisconsin, a CPA, a retired alderman. Center for Resilient Cities is on there. MLK Economic Development. So.
Marcia Caden Kaplan was a purple professor here.
Oh, was she here? Yeah. So.
And as far as you know, the board is selected by the board as sort of cooperative.
Yeah, system. I don't think there's like I don't think there's elections to the board. It's just not.
Right,
yeah.
It's just
a typical nonprofit.
Yeah, I'd say it's an appointed board.
So probably the origin was Will Allen asked a bunch of people initially,
yeah,
if you want to be on the board. They said yes.
Right, as a guiding force.
Yeah, okay. And then once the board was established, it has probably autonomy. That is, Will can't kick somebody off the board once it's established,
right,
probably. You know, if it's a nonprofit.
Right.
And then when people leave the board selects new members, probably.
Probably. Mike, we also had an innate question about whether it was over-dependent on Will as an individual figure. And, you know, yeah, I mean, my own personal, I mean, probably. I mean, you know, he's certainly a pivotal figure, you know, in that organization. I mean, and as he's gotten more prominent, you know, nationally and internationally, I think that he becomes some more. But that's not to say that I don't think that he tries to do that, but I certainly think that he is, he's big enough now, not just physically, but, you know, just in terms of influence, that a lot of growing power is attributed to him. That being said, you know, I think that Karen Parker would be a really good interview. I mean, I did a really long interview with her, and a few of them, so... She's less known, certainly unknown. I mean, nobody would know who she is. But she does a lot of work, and she's been with Will prior to getting to Growing Power. So she's got his history. It goes further than the acquisition of that land. Start. Let's see. Yeah, your question about where's the structural accountability, you know, I thought was a really good question just in terms of decision making, but also just, you know, could it reproduce? I mean, is it able to sustain itself beyond Will? And yeah, I didn't look at that at all. So I think it's a great question though. And do workers participate in vision making? Was another something that you wanted or kind of were thinking about? And I think they have a lot of I think the workers have a lot of say in what goes on. I mean, they're treated very well. I mean, there's a lot of communication among, because there's not a lot of employees, so they do a lot of communication amongst themselves, and Will is certainly very amenable to ideas and, you know, to talking to him, and he encourages other people to talk. So on the one hand, I think he is a really prominent figure. I also think that there's a pretty good sense of communication among all the employees.
But it would basically be an informal mechanism,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And again, I did this 4 or 5 years ago, so keep in mind that, you know, it's got bigger.
A related question, do you know who owns the land?
Oh, like, is it in Will's name?
Mm-hmm.
I would say yes, but I don't know for sure.
So Growing Power as a nonprofit is potentially leasing this property from Will Allen.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know that. I don't know that.
You said he bought the property, so unless he did a gifting mechanism,
yeah,
or some kind of weird legal thing where they transferred the ownership, then he would be the owner.
Yeah.
How about the label properties? I mean, is it the inner city farm or is it outside?
Oh, so that was another question about the farm, about where the farm was located. And there's two. So there's the property that Growing Power sits on, and then they also own property in Merton. Somebody said it was Burton, but it's Merton.
Oh, I thought it said Burton.
And then I was like, did I write? You know, I don't think, you know. But anyway, Merton is just, it's in Waukesha County. So I mean, it's relatively close. But it's not on the, you know, it's 40 acres, not there. But it's off-site. So the Rainbow Food Cooperative, the Rainbow Farmers Cooperative gathers food from there, but also from other members from other farms. So it's not just what's there. Okay.
I suspect at this point the land is probably owned by Growing Power, not by Will, as he may have individually, you know, initiated this thing.
I don't know. I think that would be a good question, because when he spoke in Madison last year, it sounded like it was his farm out there in Burton.
Oh, the farm. Yeah, I meant the one in town.
Yeah,
the property. Yeah, the land on Silver Spring, like that.
No, he didn't refer to it one way.
Yeah, no. I was referring to where the hoops are. You know, the in town Silver Spring.
I agree. It's logical.
Yeah, I know. That's a good question.
But how would the nonprofit have raised the money to buy it? You know, it's quite valuable.
Right.
Right.
That's a question.
Because by, I mean, you'd have to be paying property taxes and all that if it was just privately owned by him. Yeah. So this way,
yeah.
That's.
Or at least the history of that would be interesting.
Yeah.
I'm sure
is somebody kind of, well, somebody should be keeping, wasn't keeping notes, somebody keep notes on issues that we'd like to get information about, just to.
Like questions or something. So, Joao? Okay. So, address the issue about whether it was actually a new social movement rather than a void between state and the market. Whether or not they were just incapable of addressing that, right? So that the market-based grocery, which led to food desert, right, in that area, versus that the state was unable to, you know, the state had issues in terms of food security with the EBT or with program or whatever, and so that maybe it was, instead of a social movement, just some kind of addressing it as more of a void in between, right, those two?
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of weird?
Yeah, more to think like in the social economy terms.
Yeah.
Rather something that both the market and the state were unable to provide.
Right.
It was necessary, the need was there.
Right.
And the sort of new act we emerged to fill that need.
Right. And I heard of the social economy, so, you know, in thinking about that, you know, I think, I don't know that the two are mutually exclusive, that you couldn't both be a new social movement,
mm-hmm.
but and I agree that, you know, it's a void, and then we'd say, wow, is it an actual failure? And it seems harsh to say it's a failure, but, you know, and that arose as a result of this deficit, you know, I don't know. That there was a void, that, you know, that the market-based economy failed, like out and out failed, you know, and so it created this, you know, Growing Power emerged out of that, or, you know, is there somewhere, like, it just wasn't doing a good job, versus, like, it had, you know, completely failed, but.
I would also just, I mean, it seemed like sort of the way that you framed it was in terms of there was this, you use this exact phrase of like a food desert,
yeah.
But if you look sort of the practical operations of the organization, I mean, they're sending food baskets to places that didn't have a void. So they're actually acting to use your language, pragmatically, partially filling a void, but also partially, in a sense, sort of competing.
Right. So part of it's access, you know, it does provide access, but they also, not just access in that local neighborhood, but elsewhere, where you're right, you know, it might be addressing, you know, lack of, not just any kind of food, but lack of, you know, fresh produce, for example, or, so there are kind of multiplicity of goals, you know, that, you know, the location of Growing Power might be addressing one of those, but it's Yeah, I mean, it's going out further into the community, addresses other issues.
Will Allen defines the rubric as the good food movement, not local food. As his message is good food, which includes access to good food. I mean, and when I've heard him speak, the strictly localist aspect of it is not really emphasized. It comes up, but only as an adjunct to good food. So that might define, that might actually locate him somewhat differently from the broader alternative agro-food movement.
Right, which is one of the, you know, one of the things that, I mean, one of my reasons why I got interested in this and, you know, was, I do think, and I like the word dogmatic, somebody was talking about that in their comments about the alternative food movement, I think, can be pretty, you know, dogmatic. And when the Market Basket Program tried to get into Madison, you know, they're like, oh, no, we're not going to take that because that's not local food. You know, you use food that's not local. And, you know, we just do, buy fresh, buy local. We just want all local stuff. So it was that kind of notion of, is that the only solution, you know, this localized food system? And was one way that I thought, okay, well, you know, yeah, well, doesn't talk about local because they don't source locally. They do sometimes, you know, when they have it available, but it's not their only criteria. You know, they've got other goals that they're trying to meet in terms of racial equality and other things besides just, you know, the local food. So, yeah, he's all about good food. The other thing you had was about the collaboration with other businesses, you know, in Milwaukee. And, you know, I was in Milwaukee for the time that I wrote this, but I wasn't otherwise. So I didn't have a really good broad sense of what other organizations were. I did know about who they partnered with, you know, to do different things, you know. And they weren't necessarily, I mean, they were more businesses, like Lakefront Brewery, you know. They got a lot of their waste from the schools, I mean, you know, Milwaukee Public Schools or Marquette or the Walnut Way Group for distribution. So they had some, but I don't probably have a good, you know, whether they were trying to create, you know, a social economy sector, I don't feel like I have a good, I think they would support that idea, but that wasn't something I necessarily looked at, nor would I feel like I could say, I mean, I think they would support it, but I don't know whether they were actively working towards doing that.
What I think is interesting about specifically the case of Milwaukee is its economic trajectory as a city. So, and you take, of course, that into account. So what happened to the city? The city was a big city with a lot of industries and it got deindustrialized. And you have all those neighborhoods where it's basically just like if they had faced an earthquake. When I go there, now that I'm living, it's really shocking. Mm-hmm. And you don't see grocery stores, you don't see anything. There is no service. So, and even I was reading the newspaper, the pizza delivery now decided that they are not delivering to the neighborhoods on the west, which is where growing power is. Mm-hmm. So you have all the to the extent that everything is shut down for people who live on that part of the city, you have a real opportunity for an alternative development. So I have a lot of questions about whether they were networking, because I'm sure there are many possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the history of Milwaukee is, you know, especially, you know, when they built the interstates and 41, I think it is, that splits the city. There's quite a bit of there's been quite a bit of impact socially and racially and the how that city's evolved even in the last 50 or 60 years. So.
By the way, it does say Burton on page 5 with a B. And there is a place called Burton, Wisconsin that's by Iowa, that's a farm place. So
that's too far.
It invites some misunderstanding.
I'll have to go through that and see if that's like elsewhere, if I can change it. Oh, yeah, so it's Burton.
Okay.
Yeah, just a related comment to Joao's. Because one of the other things I was curious, you touch on it, but the role of education, his commitment, or their commitment to education and innovation in farming and innovation in urban farming, creating farms out of, you know, blacktop parking lots, all of those kinds of things. I mean, it strikes me that one of the answers to your question would be that at this point, much of that sort of commitment and activity has gone into education rather than into building relationships in alternative education, either by putting them on themselves or the schools rather than the business relationships, but that's a pretty important piece maybe of the story.
Yes, and in fact, a couple of you mentioned or picked up on that quote about about the lines coming out the door.
Mm-hmm.
Hang on a second. Let's see, because this has to do with the education issue. Oh, for the first few years, the store was open.
What page?
Page 51. This was from an interview, so. But unlike a conventional grocer, making the store profitable is not the most important part of growing power, quite the contrary. For the first few years the store was open, there were lines out the door on a regular basis. For some, that would be an indicator that they needed to expand operations. The director, though, instead took it as an opportunity to reflect on the organization as a whole. While doing so, he saw an unmet need and thus turned attention to education. He believed there was an opportunity to educate youth in the importance of healthy food and sustainable agriculture. The store manager remembers it. I watched the store go under, but then I watched something else blossom. So, Karen, you can't see the forest, look at the big picture. And Eric, you had a question about that, about
how did that trigger what the relationship was? Well, also, I didn't get why it was going under if there were lines going out the door.
Right.
It seems like
so that it was, that there was a lack of, they weren't ready for that. Right? They weren't ready for the onslaught of interest in it. And so his approach to all this interest and all these people who are interested in it was not to expand, but to teach people how to do it for themselves, mm-hmm. and to build educational, you know, to develop the kid program so that, you know, there wasn't this overdependence on them, but that he would try to build, you know, other organizations to develop their own capacity to do the work that they were doing.
But that wouldn't make the store go under. That phrase.
That's not my. I mean, that's
yeah.
That's their phrase. So I mean, yeah.
On a second listen, because I was confused right too. Maybe what it just means is just that we instead of focusing our efforts further on the store,
mm-hmm.
which because there were lines out the door, that could have been an opportunity to further focus on the store, but we sort of let it. We sort of moved our attention elsewhere. It didn't actually go under, but maybe it moved down the priority list.
Yeah, that's just her. That's just her.
But it still exists.
Bingo. Yeah. It does.
If I might make a suggestion,
yeah.
It wasn't transparent that education refers to meeting the same need as serving those things. That you're trying to teach the people to do those specific things for themselves.
Okay.
When I said education, my mind just went to education broadly, and I thought this director is taking some sort of hallucinogenic drugs if he thinks that because there's lines outside the door for food, what we need is better access to schools.
Yeah.
It's a specific type of schools. So a little bit of elaboration would have clarified.
But they don't take initiatives either, right? They just spread the word, sort of. I mean, this education, what you're talking about, has no return for them. I mean, it doesn't increase the ability of them. They just spread the word about having good food and, about the idea. I mean, they just spread the idea. I mean, they don't take any initiatives to open up any.
They do training. I mean, their big focus is on training. I mean, and part of it was this idea about regional centers, which is why this thing in Madison was started, you know, right? It was this idea that we were going to expand it regionally so that there wasn't so much of a dependence on what was going on in Milwaukee, but that you could develop regional centers. And there's supposed to be other ones beyond the one in Madison. I mean, there's other ones across the country that were going to emerge and develop in the world. You know?
Is there one in Chicago?
So
what's the Chicago? Is it an actual growing power center?
Yeah.
They have a very small farm there. Like in Jackson Park, they have something, and they planted something in Grand Park.
And that's his daughter runs that. So.
Yeah.
It has the same kind of infrastructure with the tilapia beds and tanks and the.
I didn't go there, so I'm not sure.
From what I've seen on the internet, it doesn't seem like it.
I know they do the market, and they do the farm, the urban farm, and the education piece in the schools.
If they have the hoop farms, they when you go to Growing Power, what they emphasize at, in the hoop farms is this integration of protein production and greens production through the tilapia. That's being at the very core, that and worms.
And this is what this Saturday's event is about as well. Like, Willan was there as well, and they were building the hoop house. They were showing how to build.
With the tilapia stuff, too? Did they talk about that?
I arrived a bit late, so I didn't hear any speeches. They were literally just building the hoop house itself. So there wasn't much growing going on.
Well, there's also emphasis that he has with the tilapia thing, is that the stuff is put together with just random scraps of stuff. I mean, it's not highly expensive materials that he uses to do what he does. And his, thing is on keeping, capital investment low and, your production high. And so if you could teach people how to do it, then that would be better, because then they could do it in an inexpensive way without a lot of capital. Right. So Matthew. All right. So you suggested using the table or a list to kind of enumerate the critiques, kind of more of a matching kind of idea. So I like that. Some connections. Because I've probably got to the point where I tend to make lots of steps in between the connections that were really explicit. You also suggested about the methods, more about who the staff were relative to others. Right, and I just didn't do a lot about the employee relationship and staff, so I appreciated that continued kind of feedback on that. Lack of budget information, again, not something I looked at, budgets, so I didn't see that, and that seems, now, in retrospect, there's a lot of things I think, that would have been really useful to see, and especially after the work on that. Well, as you call it, board, I think, well, budgets are really important in terms of, priorities and how you kind of reproduce what you're doing. So, but I didn't do that. Basic info about the, growing power number of employees, I think it was maybe between 8 and 10 people. And then you had the burden already, so it's good to see. That was kind of... Does that address some other things in there?
To follow up a little bit on the financial stuff, if you want to describe their activities and what they're doing day to day, then maybe you don't need to worry about finances. But if you want to make a claim that this is a replicable and upscalable model, the natural question that follows is how do they pay for it all? And if there's some specific financial arrangement where a very wealthy benefactor, whose name might be Will Allen, is sustaining all of this at a loss, then it's not upscale. Now, maybe that's not the case at all, but the reader doesn't know that unless there's at least a little bit of commentary on that.
Yeah, it seems like a glaring omission. I'm like, oh yeah, that would have been, because, a lot of it is donation based, people donating, and not users necessarily, but people who support the cause kind of thing, so.
Yeah, you probably none of the same thing, so
please.
Well, Emmanuel and I were talking about this with respect to the Madison thing earlier, that the replicability isn't necessarily, obviated by the fact that you're getting inflows of capital from rich people or from the state or from private firms or whatever. That's just something that, if that's the model, then you need to find those sources of support whenever you replicate it. Whether that's, taxes that fund what you're doing, or, corporations that are happy to associate themselves with this and throw money at you. So it doesn't mean it's sustainable by itself, but I'm not sure it doesn't mean it's not replicable.
Yeah, I mean, in that respect, it would be interesting what the kind of financial model is.
Exactly, yeah.
Whether they're trying to actually replicate themselves just through the income the sales of vegetables, or whether they're actually on an operating business sense, like actually dependent on
I mean, it'd be great to know that, because they sell the restaurants, you know, but I can't imagine that, you know, the when you see their square footage, you know, that they could, you know, pay X number of people and run all the stuff and do all these things just for that. So it's a, I mean, it seems very obvious now.
We could get their financial stuff off of the 90.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than taking time to.
They're building a very big new expansion in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee site, that's going to be a vertical greenhouse. It's supposed to have all these tiers kind of offset. There's a kind of architectural drawing there. And that's going to cost millions. I mean, that's a big, expensive thing. And it seems like it's foundation grants and corporate support, because Growing Power has a lot of good PR for corporations that contribute to it. So some of these corporations may themselves be kind of, quote, socially responsible corporations that have, not just for image purposes, but may have some genuine commitments towards sustainability and the like. You know, it's, that can happen. That wasn't so clear to me when I was there. You know, what the balance between Will Allen taking advantage of his ability to kind of co-opt these corporate funds to do really good things versus becoming dependent upon corporations that have ulterior motives. You know. Joao, you were going
to. Yeah, that's very different from another experience that I got to know about at the U.S. Social Forum, which was in Detroit, about urban gardening as well. And I think the name of the organization was Young Radical African American Urban Gardening, something like that. And their strategy was that the city of Detroit was unable to maintain the city parks. So they were just... the city couldn't put money on the parks, and they would just go there and take the parks, and they would negotiate and bargain with the city to get the park and organize urban gardening, and through that they would take care of the park as well, and they were able to do that, and not, so they didn't rely on private money, and they were able to reproduce, and then now at 10-12 places in Detroit.
That's amazing.
It's a complicated name, but I think it's Young Radical African American Urban Gardening.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I'll mention about the corporate connection, you know, is some of their Market Basket program, you know, they have deliveries at companies like in town, so they'll have, and I don't remember the name because I went on one of the routes one time, and it was like a coffee company or some kind of a big, you know, really industrial based company. But anyway, so they have some of the higher, and I don't know that they get money from them, but they do have relationships other than some of the donations, like the Whole Foods. So we talked about the ability to scale up, which I think is, you know, is something we talked about a little bit already, and kind of its limitation. From the model that I was most familiar with them, their interest was really in scaling out, and in kind of not in necessarily replicating themselves, but in getting other locations started up, and that they would be able to, you know, create and meet a similar mission. But that, I guess I didn't necessarily see that they wanted to have other ones. Could you do it on a bigger scale?
Yeah.
Right? Were you the one that talked about the agriculture? Like, could you do it on a larger scale because of the nature of the you know, and the agriculture? You know, if you needed to scale up, you would need more land than, you know, 40 acres to provide food. I don't remember that.
One of the principles that are in play here has to do with whether or not there are economies of scale in the technologies that are adopted. And there, Will Allen seems quite deliberate in trying to develop technologies that don't have economies of scale. That is that the economy, I mean, they may have economies of scale between tiny and small, but he wants technologies in which the full productivity advantages kick in pretty quickly, so they're modular. And that seems to me, you know, in agriculture in general, and in thinking about alternatives to capitalist forms of enterprise more generally, is a neglected kind of issue. There's different technologies have different economies of scale, and therefore you can't use the technology efficiently at a small scale. It's wasteful. So from an ecological point of view, if you have a production function that has big economies of scale, it's wasteful to have small units. That was the problem, you know, China's disastrous effort at producing these tiny steel plants in the Great Leap Forward, which was a catastrophe, was because they were completely inattentive to the material constraints for certain kinds of production processes where there were big economies of scale. Now, but agriculture does seem to be a case where there are choices. You can have capital-intensive economy of scale type agriculture or modular, depending upon how you think through the problem of intensity. And in Will Allen's case, I mean, his perhaps over preoccupation, but his stress on worms and on the quality of the soil, the basic argument is you can get huge productivity gains at very small scale if you do it right. Yeah.
I mean, I assume that the reason why he wants to avoid economies of scale and keep it small and modular is precisely because he wants to replicate it, so that the barriers to entry are pretty low.
Right.
So I mean, that's really what replicate I meant by scaling scale. It up. I didn't necessarily mean that they meant like sizes, that they were replicating it more.
Right. Like, yeah. So it's easier to replicate something if it doesn't have economies of scale, but it makes it hard to grow. If Will Allen wanted his own operation to grow, then coordination, there's diseconomies of scale that kick in pretty quickly if you get too big, because you need then more staff to just do the coordinating functions. And the kind of ratio between the staff that's kind of managing the stuff and the staff that's doing the work gets adverse if the organization gets big and there's no economies of scale. So people talk about diseconomies of scale when the bureaucratic and organizational problems get larger as you get bigger.
But is this approach not contradictory to the implicit aim of trying to service as many poor, like food desert kind of places as possible? No, I mean, that's like an inherent limitation of modeling, right? They're trying not to scale up, like scale up in your sense of
but
worse than they can't service them.
But who's the they?
Yeah.
I mean, you said that, like, I'm not sure if I remember, but like, you said that 300 people received the baskets.
As part of the program, sure.
And I mean, that doesn't seem to be the aim of the organization. Right? I guess the aim of the organization seems to be to, like, increase access as broadly and widely as possible.
Increase knowledge. I think increasing knowledge is what his main goal is. Is he wants, you know, he's happy for you to come and learn how to do vermicomposting so that you can go do it at your house. You could go do it in your neighborhood. You know, and I think that that's the access issue for him more so than. I mean, I think the Market Basket program addresses an issue of food security to some degree. You know, but I also kind of look at it as kind of PR a little bit, you know, people, you know, being able to see, oh, you know, you can get, you know, produce. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that's a mixture of it. I mean, the work that he does with the kids, you know, in Milwaukee Public Schools, you know, that's pretty intense, you know, and he's really interested in getting classrooms to have, you know, worms and to have gardens and to grow food. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I was there on several occasions when classes came in and did the tour and learned about it and touch the dirt and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, the work that he does with the teenagers coming out of there and learning how to be an entrepreneur to make a living out of gardening. And, you know, maybe that's, you know, if that's that he's, you know, he's trying to grow farmers, you know, mm-hmm. He wants more kids. So I think there's a lot of emphasis on that.
So, when you said economies of scale, so my understanding is that economies of scale try to respond to transaction costs. I guess that's the idea, is that like once you've already sort of paid the costs of establishing these relationships to bring together the components to make the product, then you can ramp it up. So then the question is, so how does he, how does Growing Power avoid those transaction costs? What do they do? And then as we're talking right now about this, and we're talking about how education is a part of it, and you know, you have these little small technologies, basic technologies, it sounds like it's sort of like a network.
No, so, I mean, this is a complicated economics issue, the economies of scale and diseconomies of scale and how to think about it. I was referring to the way in which different technologies have different curves. So, for example, the shift to new technologies of printing have drastically reduced the economies of scale of publishing. So the reason why big publishers have an advantage is not because the marginal cost of producing a large run is that different from a small run. It's not true any longer. The marginal costs don't vary very much between a small run and a big run because the typesetting used to be the case that typesetting was a fantastically expensive part of a production of a book. And therefore, if you produced 500 copies, they'd be incredibly expensive because you'd have to pay off the full cost of the typesetting. If you produced 50,000, it'd be cheap. But now, typesetting is cheap, so that the big setup costs are low, and therefore the new technologies allow for lots of small runs, and they allow for what's called print-on-demand to produce proper books, in which the cost of producing one book isn't that different from producing the 1,000th and first book if you do a run, right? So that allows for a different kind of publishing. We still have these huge giant publishers. Now the reason for that is because they control bookstores. That is, they control distribution, but they do it through the exercise of power. They don't do it through technologies. Now that's, so in agriculture, there's some kinds of agriculture, in the sort of sociology of agriculture, in which the technologies give very big economies of scale. Wheat farming is an example. The combines that harvest wheat cost $500,000 or something. So you can't have a 20-acre wheat farm because the capital costs are. Agriculture in the United States is the highest capital intensity. It's higher capital intensity than auto production and steel production because of the capital equipment needed for, you know, for wheat and corn harvesters and all that stuff. There are different economies of scale, but technological innovation can have a big impact on that. So the idea with Growing Power would be you could have 20 Growing Powers in Milwaukee easily by just replicating small hoop farms with tilapia, having one hoop with its composting and vermiculture and tilapia gives you almost all the economies of scale that you would have if you had 10. You know, so it kicks in pretty quickly. When you double the size, you're just going to double the productivity. It's not that if you double the size, you're going to triple the productivity. And therefore, you can have lots of small ones. And I think part of the idea is to try to figure out technologies that have that property. Because then you can get an elementary school to have a hoop farm and to actually produce food for people. It's not just as a kind of toy garden, but a real garden.
So, I mean, this is then directly also linked to the financial question and like the sustainability, I guess, of the population. Because it's an open question whether they actually, I mean, it might be that they're productive in output sense, but whether it's actually so cost efficient, you know, can they really produce food at such a low price that they compete with like these high scale farms, right? And I mean, that would be interesting to know. And like whether they subsidize essentially their food sales whether the food sales are like competitive in the market on such a small scale.
Right.
And whether the if it lacks, if it's not competitive, that is, if the per unit cost of a pound of tilapia produced by Will Allen is more than produced by a big tilapia farm, is the what's the reason for the fact that they can't compete?
Yeah.
Is it because the big farm, the big farms, when they sell to grocery stores, can, because of their power with respect to the stores, I mean, what's the mechanism involved in making it more expensive? I think on the, from what he said on the tilapia, he thinks it is, they're actually cheaper because they can deliver it to market with low transportation costs. They're producing it right there. His claim was that it was actually more productive, more efficiently produced in this small, decentralized way.
So then it becomes an issue of distribution.
Yeah, so the distribution costs are another matter, but the actual production costs are. There's one other, I mean, as long as we're just sort of working our way around some of these issues, there's one other very general question about the meaning of price in these contexts and its relationship to costs. When we look at market prices don't reflect positive externalities at all of the production, nor do they represent the negative externalities of production. They're just the, you know, in a more or less competitive environment, which agriculture is, you know, more or less. I mean, there are these big agribusinesses, but there's still a fair amount of competition. The monetary price is more or less in line with the monetary costs of production, you know, plus a markup. But the costs of production don't reflect the negative externalities, and the price doesn't embody the positive externalities. So one argument for why permanent subsidy, that is, public funds, should underwrite things like Will Allen's operations and make the price that things can sell lower than they would be without those subsidies. One argument for it is that that's simply a way of recognizing the positive externalities of having a decentralized good food source in the central cities. That they're huge positive externalities. If that was done on a wide enough basis so that it would provide a major part of the food that people got. And those positive externalities should be reflected in the lower price of what's being sold. And the only way to do that in practice is for it to, for there to be government transfers. And so the transfers should not, I don't know if I made this point here, but it's one that I think is important to emphasize. The transfers should not be viewed as subsidies. The transfer should be viewed just as the mechanism to get the correct prices when there's positive externalities. It's simply a way for the society to pay for its part of the price of the good. It's the collective payment for the positive externalities.
And it's very difficult to measure the positive externalities.
Right. It's difficult, but...
But that system is already in place in milk, for instance. I mean, that's the old one. That's the oldest one.
Yeah, subsidized milk because we want
because
children.
Of the, because of the feeling that fresh milk should be available. You know?
Because of the vitamin D.
What?
Because of the vitamin D.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just, it's an ancient, it's an old, old system. So, but it's there, and it's it works the way you described.
And of course, it, you know, as soon as you, the advantage of just leaving things up to the market is that it avoids, you know, rent seeking to some extent. It makes it harder for powerful groups to make claims that they're positive externalities so that they can appropriate part of the surplus through a subsidy. But so that's a problem which is a difficult one. But I don't think the fact that that's a problem implies that it's a fair test of the economic viability of these alternative systems, whether or not they can compete effectively head-to-head with capitalist firms.
Particularly in an environment of huge subsidization in most other commodities in agriculture.
So it's even the fact that capitalist firms get all these indirect subsidies in other ways too, but even a...
Continue?
Yeah, back to your list.
All right, back to my list. Trevor. So one of the main kind of questions it seems like you had was about how do they strike a balance between pragmatism and a pursuit of social goals? And, you know, that was one of the things that I hoped that I addressed and was one of the things that I thought they did a pretty good job in. And kind of how they balance that. So, you know, my example that I often use is with Sysco, the food, like, food service distribution company, right, that's kind of ubiquitous in terms of on campuses and everywhere. So, you know, their, you know, Will's pragmatic in terms of his desire, his overall desire to get food into Milwaukee Public Schools, to get good food, get his, you know, produce, or get fresh produce into Milwaukee Public Schools. You know, Milwaukee Public Schools said, no, we're not going to deal with different vendors. We have one vendor, which is Sysco. You know, and, you know, my argument was kind of, you know, Madison-based alternative food movements would be like, no, we're not going to do anything with Sysco. You know, Sysco is the evil, you know, company. And Will said, well, you know, I'm going to contact Sysco, and I'm going to get them to deliver my food. And so he developed a relationship with Sysco so that they could deliver the produce into MPS. So I feel like they're fairly pragmatic in the means they use to achieve their goals. And that's a good example. You know, the other, you know, it addresses a number of other issues too, but, you know, their market basket, right, which is available year-round. So, again, you know, CSAs typically, I mean, some CSAs will continue on with, you know, chickens or eggs or other things on a year-round basis, but most CSAs are, you know, just seasonally, so maybe March or April to September. And so, you know, their interest more pragmatically was to provide, you know, fresh produce to people year-round. So they source from people other than here. And so they took on this idea when he and, you know, some other people formed that the Farmers Cooperative, was to work with some immigrant farmers and other underrepresented farmers and take their produce and ship it up here, truck it up here, and use that to supplement whatever they were able to provide in the market basket so that it could provide a year-round service or a year-round basket for people. So, again, like I looked at that as kind of a balancing act of, you know, people would say, well, that's not a real CSA. It's not local food, you know, but on a practical, pragmatic sense, it offered people, you know, produce and access year round. That was my whole kind of thing, you know.
The pragmatism is certainly there, and the question is whether this the right way to frame
right.
the pragmatism is
right.
as a collaboration with the conventional system,
right. versus
or,
something separate.
Yeah. So.
Right.
Some of these seem to be different cases. It seems to me what he's doing is, what you're talking about is prioritizing the values, and when there's a trade-off, you opt for some things over others.
Yeah.
So the trucking up fresh food from immigrant farmers
that
happens not to be local, it's just a frank recognition that locality is only one issue, and it's not a prime value. It's an instrumental value. It's in the service of something else. It's in the service of good food and fresh food and maybe some other things. But it's not that it is a value per se. It's a weak value per se. It's mostly instrumental for something else, whereas the good food for people is a prime value. That's some, you know, having good, nutritious food is one of the things that is high. So that one
But he could go get, I mean, you know, if that was his only goal, get good food to people and access, like he could, you know, go up to Pick and Save, get the food and take it to those people. Like, I felt like his support of the farmers cooperative, you know, had a direct racial.
Right, right. So I'm saying.
Oh, I see.
Right, right. So I'm saying good food would be a very high value.
Yeah.
Racial diversity, cooperatives, I mean, there's a series of other things, are close. They're either close seconds or at the same level,
okay.
Whereas locality is just an instrumental one.
Right.
Yeah. Now, there are other cases which may not. So, for example, the collaboration with Whole Foods seems a little dicier in some ways to me.
Yeah.
Just because it so is against, in general.
The consumption end of it, though, because I thought about that. I mean, right? If you look at producers and consumers, assuming that you're not producing your own food, you know, that benefits the you know, he could still
benefits,
you know,
rich consumers and producers. Yeah,
yeah.
So
yeah.
Producers benefit.
And so yeah, so you know, underserved,
okay.
Underrepresented producers. Yeah, your
get
consumers
access.
Are
right,
but
right.
You're. You know.
So that one works on, yeah. So that one works on. Let's prioritize the interests of.
Right.
Disadvantaged producers, aha, let's get them access to Whole Foods, even
yeah.
though that doesn't help all these other values.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I see.
Yeah.
I mean, I see.
So, I mean, I think the way I would think of it is that there's these values, and you ask for each of them, what are the conditions where I can work on this value?
Right.
Sometimes there are trade-offs. Sometimes there's incompatibilities. And then some things you get very worried about. So on the funding side, when Walnut Way gets funding from the Bradley Foundation, okay, money is money, you know, it's fungible. Once you've got the money, it's buy whatever you want, right? Still, Bradley Foundation is a really dark force. It's on the dark side. It's, you know, Darth Vader. I mean, it's really bad. And this may be where my dogmatism kicks in, but I get, when I see somebody funded by the Bradley Foundation.
Is it just on their website? Or can I just ask them? Is it
that Bradley
Foundation? Do you have any idea what the level of funding is?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I just heard them talk and
so
they, it was on their, low, you know, on their
yeah.
list.
I just wanted to just quickly respond to that. If it is the case that there is some hierarchy of values, and that is what sort of helps to meet this kind of blend between values and pragmatism, then we should expect to be able to see that hierarchy of values somewhere, whether it's in some sort of constitution of the nonprofit, or even whether it's in the activities of the organization, you know, where do they put their money, or maybe it might be in... Maybe it might be in sort of their distribution of funding sources. Maybe if they're getting most of their money from a foundation, that this is very much going to shape the priorities they make. Or maybe it's just all in the head of Will Allen, and that he's sort of making ad hoc. I mean, but that would seem to be difficult. So I'm very curious about how those decisions...
Because it was one of my interview questions, right, was... this about the different prior, I mean, about the different values, you know, and was there a priority over one value over another?
Right.
I didn't focus on it in here, but that was one of the data I have about what the employees' responses were. And I think one of them's in there, like, they're all, you know, we can kind of do them all, so yeah. I like that idea.
But I mean, then the question is how the decision made stably. And, I mean, if when they're, I mean, now they have a good leader, so he can balance between the many values, and then he can prioritize something. But if the decision making process is not like a stable or democratic,
like the formal structure,
yeah.
Kind of informal versus formal, and yeah, the formal structure is.
The way we've been talking about here, I think that we've pushed it a little bit further than in the comments I sent Kathleen's comments, which I didn't include in the interrogations. I mean, not because I didn't want to share them. It's just that they're more just directed at specific points. But another way of thinking about this is that you have a pluralism of strategies and a pluralism of values. And different specific projects prioritize different values, as opposed to you have a unique rank ordered list of values, and every project has to respect that list. So the example that you, the way you explained here, the whole food story, which I, in my comments to you, was kind of, you know, stuck up my nose at, you know, as really seeming completely out of whack with growing power's main priorities. And that's because I saw the priorities as the primarily the disadvantaged population of consumers and the access to good food and whatever else one might say about Whole Foods. It doesn't provide access to good food for poor people, which is so expensive. And then you raise, well, but it does provide a good source of income for disadvantaged producers. So the way then to think about that is that it's not a rank-ordered list of priorities. Providing opportunities for disadvantaged producers to produce good organic food and find a way of selling it is one priority. Having access for poor people to good food is another priority. Having environmental sustainability is another priority. And then different projects will prioritize different priorities. So the access to Whole Foods is a very good solution if you can really get Hmong farmers you know, to be able to produce vegetables in a regular way to Whole Foods locally, that's a good solution for them. So, I mean, that's, you know, rather than having a coherent list that always tells you what to do, you then think about different. And then it's not so much, I mean, you can then describe some of those as involving a collaboration with the conventional system. But it's not, but that's in a way almost incidental. That's just a solution to a problem. Mm-hmm. How do you realize this value? What's the best project for this value? Mm-hmm. So you're not, you're rigid in a way about your values. You're not going to say, we're going to engage in a range of things that don't pay attention to disadvantaged producers. That is a value. We're going to really try to find a solution to it. To realize, to help them.
Could you turn that into a what you would consider to be a more structural collaboration, or a
well, I mean, I don't know. You know, I'm just sort of
meandering
around here.
Just for example,
the problem for the disadvantaged producers is that they have to have an outlet to sell in a stable way at a good price, their products. So you can't get the disadvantaged producers directly selling to the disadvantaged consumers and solve the problem for the disadvantaged producers, because they're not going to make enough money off of selling to disadvantaged producers, consumers. So the solution to the disadvantaged consumers has to be different from the disadvantaged producers. You want to solve both of them, so you need multiple projects. And then the idea that you then collaborate with a prominent corporation that's willing to collaborate for the one problem, you know, does seem like a good pragmatic solution. I don't know why I reacted so queasily to that framing. I guess it was because when I read the paper, most of the descriptions and stuff were not about collaborating with established firms, and it was mostly about how they were acting on these values. And then just in some context, they had to do a collaboration in order to act on their values. And that's why I didn't think it was the best way to frame the whole agenda.
Right.
I mean, pragmatism is, though, I mean, it certainly has this very practical orientation towards what he's doing.
Yeah.
It wasn't Whole Foods' 34% profit margin that bothered you.
Well,
I mean, is that consistently true that they have double-digit profit margins?
Well, okay. So this is my other thing, that when I went back to reread this. So That is, that's a gross profit margin. So comparable gross profit margins to like a Safeway would be like 28%. So they're higher, but they're not.
Okay. The 2% was wrong.
The 2% is a net margin.
The 2% is right for grocery stores net, right? 2 to 3.
And I don't know what Whole Foods net margin is, but yeah. All right.
I have a friend who calls them whole paycheck.
Right. Right.
Or whole check.
That's right.
I just this is just a not quite a non sequitur, but I was just for a meeting I have in New York. I was reading a paper about microfinance and microcredit, but very critical of the Grameen Bank sort of thing. But they were discussing a gigantic Mexican microfinance business that had an IPO in which people made zillions of dollars, and in which the effective interest rates on these was 100% in Mexico. And in passing, he said, and this is 3 times what it is in Bangladesh. And so I thought, okay, so it's only 33% in Bangladesh. You know, it's just, I mean, basically about the...
It's 4 times than in Bolivia, I think. It's around 24 to 30 in Bolivia. So.
Yeah, I mean... 20 or 30% interest rates on these microfinance loans, and seeing that as the good guy, the good, honest credit system is only charging 30%.
Extended credit to people who formerly weren't seen as creditworthy.
Well, he got into the Nobel Peace
Prize.
The Peace Prize? Yeah, it was the Peace Prize, not the Nobel Economy. It was the Peace.
All right, Nina. We talked about a lot about that, about the prioritization of goals, right?
Yeah.
Did you have any other ones or any other?
No, it's a bit the same. And then there was this other issue. I don't know if you should bring it up. Like standing one step back and like when I read the paper, I saw all those areas they want to focus on. I thought it's actually weird why this. In some way, very different focuses have come in under the same movement. By local and health, in some way, is the same. And like it's like Willy Street, all the other things we're discussing, it's really wide and there's a lot of things under it. And yeah, I think it's, yeah, my whole point was it can make it maybe harder sometimes. And it sounds like a growing power. In your version, if your version is right, it's maybe not that big a problem. But as a radio station, it sounds like they're really trying to do a lot of things at the same time.
So. Well, in their hiring, I noticed under employment, they're hiring a dietitian, registered dietitian, to do work in schools as an employee of Growing Power. That's interesting.
How much are they offering?
Okay. But a salary commensurate with experience, I believe. Something about nonprofit salary. But again, you know, it's a tie-in with health.
And disadvantaged schools was mentioned.
Yeah. So, yeah.
But it tells you a lot.
All right. Yeah.
Can we take a break?
Yes, let's take it. That's right. We've been going for almost 2 hours. Let's take it.
It's quite a name.